I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guests are venture capitalists David Hornick, Amy Arrett, and Hunter Walk. They're joined in conversation by television news veteran Sue Kwan. And now join Barbara Lane on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces our in-depth discussion on the current state of venture capital.
There's a great deal of hyperbole and misconception about the world of venture capital. Ideas scribbled on napkins, making overnight billionaires of hoodie-wearing geeks and the like, you know the story. Well, we've assembled three of Silicon Valley's most knowledgeable VCs, one former VC, to tell us what's real and what's not, and explain it all to us. For the past 20 years, David Hornick, general partner at August Capital, has worked closely with technology companies to help them grow and prosper. Since that time, he's invested in dozens of companies across the software spectrum, including Aardvark, acquired by Google, Evite, acquired by Ticketmaster, and Splunk. Hunter Walk is a co-founder and partner at Homebrew Management, a venture capital firm specializing in seed, startup, and incubation investments. He joined Google in 2003 as managing product and sales efforts for AdSense and served as the head of product at YouTube. Amy Arrett was a general partner and ran the Bay Area office of Maveron, a leading venture capital firm focusing on investing in consumer-facing companies. Prior to Maveron, Amy was the CEO of Olivia, repositioning the travel business as a complete lifestyle company. She's currently CEO and co-founder of Madison Reed, which seeks to revolutionize every aspect of the hair care business, the home hair care business. And they all have aspects of their backgrounds that seem to have nothing to do with money. David Hornick's master's in criminology, the year Hunter Walk spent at Late Night with Conan O'Brien, and Amy Arrett's fanaticism about the Yukon Huskies. Go figure. Here to guide tonight's discussion is TV news veteran Sue Kwan, who currently serves as head of communications for Honor, a fast-growing startup modernizing home care with innovative technology and high-quality caregivers. Please welcome all of them to the JCCSF.
Okay. Thanks for coming out tonight. So yes. Given everything that has happened over the weekend, we were talking back in the green room about how people are feeling. Let's go ahead and start off with you.
I feel like crap. Thank you very much. I think it's a horrifying time. I spent, I actually to a certain degree credit this to Hunter, because Hunter from very early on in this election has taken the position that we're all business people. We have to take seriously our job. We have to take seriously the companies in which we invest. We have to take seriously the entrepreneurs to whom we owe allegiance, all those things. And yet, Hunter from the beginning has said, this is an important election. This is something that matters. And he has taken to the airwaves. His Twitter feed.
Yeah,
his
Twitter.
Yeah, well, the Twitter airwaves. To express his position, and I have agreed. You know, ultimately, I think we need to be vocal and we need to stand up. You know, that we can't sit back and just say like, oh, it's business as usual. Let's go. Let's heads down and focus on building our businesses. So you know, this weekend, Max Levchin, who's one of the founders of PayPal, tweeted, I grew up a Soviet Jew and came to this country as an immigrant. Run out of the country, and came to America. This, and I'm paraphrasing clearly. And the reaction to that, my reaction to that tweet was to say, you know what, my great grandparents were Soviet Jews. They came to this country to run away from oppression. Exactly. There were others who then responded. My grandparents were Soviet Jews. My great grandparents were Soviet Jews. So Silicon Valley is filled with folks who are descendants of immigrants who have been chased, who have been and who have made lives for themselves here in America, made lives for themselves ultimately in Silicon Valley. And, you know, this is what is great about America, and so I think that we all have to, you know, keep echoing that message.
You're also seasoned, and I'm curious, Hunter, because you work with a lot of newer, younger CEOs. What have they been asking you today in terms of guidance, or what are some of their concerns, if any?
Well, I think it was really important. You know, David talked about being upfront about sort of our own beliefs as a venture fund, as a new venture fund. We are unafraid to project, you know, our values, knowing that we might not be right for every entrepreneur, but the ones who we're right for will sort of hear that and it'll resonate with them. At the same time, I think, you know, what you want to back always is some degree of, you know, constructive agitation. You want people who are building a company because there's a problem that they feel strongly about and they're trying to solve that they just can't believe can be solved by any other way. They're not starting a company because it's the cool thing to do or because their roommate's doing it. It's because it's the only way that they can try to fix a problem. And so these people who are generally lean in, you see a problem, you want to solve it with your hands, for the first time are confronting something that they actually feel, in many cases, you know, powerless in the moment. What's happening here? How do we fix this? This is bigger than, you know, just me or me and my co-founder or me and my family. And while that's certainly a scary feeling, you know, I think it reminds people about what community and citizenship looks like, which for a long time, at least the last decade, I think some of the technology community took their ball off the eye on. I mean, eye off the ball on. One of the reasons we named ourselves Homebrew was after the Homebrew Computer Club of the 70s and 80s met at Stanford's campus. It was where Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak met, and it was PC hobbyists doing it for the love of creating and doing it in an open way. And, you know, somewhere along the way, as we matured as a business, as an industry, you start to have different role models where what you were celebrating was the money, the notion of scale, the idea of, you know, particular pattern matching against the, you know, the white Harvard dropout, and that was what, you know, intelligence looked like. And, you know, what I like now is, you know, hearing people brag about getting into the seed round of democracy, you know, the seed round of solving problems. A lot of founders we work with, they come to us, and even if they're younger, sometimes they've come through and this might be their second company. And the first company, you know, might have been a space that they were attracted to in their 20s or was hot at the moment. And one of the things that resonates when they come back for their next company is they say, I want to work on something that matters. And you see a lot of people, you know, that's an individual decision, what that means for them, but we see a lot of entrepreneurship in health, in education, places where a few years ago you weren't thinking about startups. You know, you mentioned David's investment in Aardvark during the intro. One of the founders of Aardvark for his next company, which was acquired by Google, left Google and started AltSchool, which is, you know, not a three-year and flip it type of company. It's a, you know, 20-year opportunity to rethink education. And so, you know, you ask, what is it, you know, what does it mean in the conversations we have? Well, it means that we're both talking about working on something that matters at the micro level, you know, your company, and at the macro level, you know, being a citizen.
And it's interesting because this conversation we originally planned to talk about what is venture capital, what is the role of VC, and it seems as though it is just evolving and changing. And today, just given that we could open with a topic like this, as a reporter, when I covered technology here in San Francisco for NBC and CBS, I remember the dot-com boom, the bust, the recession, and so on. And the VCs were always the ones way in the background. You'd hear their names, or you'd see their big offices or the sign, but you never had a face on them, really. So for me, this is exciting, too. I mean, I know you all. I've followed you all. Dave, you and I went to school together. So is this a sign of change that VCs are becoming more human, or do you think it's just that you are coming out and expressing yourself?
A sign of the apocalypse. It's a sign of something.
I mean, You know, here you are, your secrets are super approachable. I don't think I ever would have thought in my wildest dreams.
Your brand is on point, Dave.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is called branding.
Look at this shirt. No, you know, it's funny. I do think it's actually, to tell you the truth, completely absurd that anyone knows what a venture capitalist is, cares what a venture capitalist is. Like, you know, the which isn't to say that we're not like trying to make companies, trying to be helpful. I think that our job is to try and be helpful, to try and help amazing entrepreneurs be successful, et cetera. But when you think about venture capital at its purest, here is what venture capitalists do. We go to some institutions or individuals and we say to them, hi, we're going to try and meet with some amazing companies and invest in them. Do you have any money you'd like us to invest in those companies? Because I don't have the money. And they go, sure, here's some money. And then I go to entrepreneurs and I say, hi, I'm wondering if you need any money. And they say, yes, I do need money. I say, funny, because I just got some money from these people and I give them the money. That is venture capital. I take some money from here, I hand it over here, and then I go, make that money more money, and then give it back to me.
So that was the definition.
So you know what? We should totally be celebrated. It's definitely the era of the venture investor, right? Now, Amy wisely was like, that's not really that satisfying. I guess I better make some things. So she now gets to collect up our money. But that, honestly, I mean, that's venture capital, right? At its purest.
You should just drop the mic. Right,
I know, just whatever.
That's it.
Yeah. Very, very
makes
nice.
You really want to work with me, right? Like, oh my God,
but,
I got to work with
you.
David
led
Hornick.
Into this. It's an interesting thing. So, Amy,
yes.
As somebody who has started a company,
yes.
Which one is harder, being a CEO? And tell us a little bit, tell the audience a little bit more about your company,
sure.
Or being a VC?
Oh boy. They're both really hard. They're hard, no, honestly, for different reasons, right? Mm-hmm. I was a venture capitalist for a good period of time, and the thing that's a little bit different about being a venture capitalist is really the truth is David and Hunter are being way too modest. You know, you need to, the biggest issue is to really pick people, right? Mm-hmm. You need to pick big spaces that you believe there's opportunities. But at the end of the day, the pattern recognition that I felt as an early stage investor was really finding what were the combination of the kinds of people that were going to have enough perseverance to live through that crazy ride that is called being an entrepreneur. And I used to describe it slightly different than my friend David, because I think in its most noble, honestly, definition, it was always started by actually early in the days of being a VC by mostly men, that's okay, that actually had outcomes because they were entrepreneurs themselves, who then had decided that they were going to pass on that mentoring, both in terms of their time, their know-how, and capital to younger entrepreneurs to help them really realize their dreams. And so, you know, I'm not trying to be too kind of, storybook here, but the way I looked at it when I was a VC is how lucky was I? Mm-hmm. You know, I got to meet incredibly smart people, and, you know, find a way to help them realize their dreams. And I think that the interesting part is most of the time if you back somebody who's a rock star or terrific, you are really spending your time just helping them around the edges. It's the ones that you have to do everything for that you're usually not backing the right people. I don't mean this in a bad way. But you're really facilitating. I think for me, one of the things that happened was as an operator by nature, I wasn't really good. David was on boards with me, so he could testify to this. He used to tell me, like, breathe, breathe. You know, hold my hands down during the meeting, my leg shaking. I'm not really good at I like to kind of own and be accountable for what's going on. So,
translation, she likes to tell people what to do.
Shut up, David. Sorry. So the real issue for me about becoming an entrepreneur, it is just kind of in my DNA to start something, to run something, and it's incredibly hard.
CEO is harder.
Because you're answering to it, that.
I was trying to be nice
to
them.
It doesn't mean that being a successful venture capitalist is easy. It's very easy to be a mediocre venture capitalist. Mm-hmm. It's hard to be a good one. But I think CEO is harder across almost every dimension, with the exception of CEOs can fire somebody if it's not working out, and once a VC makes an investment, you are with that company. You've signed up to be with that company for some case many, many, many years. And so the question that we ask ourselves before we make an investment isn't just, do we think we can return money to our investors with this investment? Mm-hmm. I was hoping you might do your voice again. Be the investor. do we want to put sweat and reputation behind this company every morning, not just cut them a check right now?
I think that's important for folks to understand, because this is what I learned as I used to do consulting for VCs, that there's a real schedule behind this. You have a meeting every Monday. Can you just explain? So now they're funded. What's the meeting schedule like? How often do board meetings happen? What are the expectations? You throw out these 10x numbers, but really, what is it? How many people are on your back? I mean, at what point do you then cut people off? I mean, tell me about your world when you're holding down her hand saying, breathe.
By the way, totally baloney. Amy and I both sat there smiling and being incredibly constructive and supportive, because that's the kind of person that we both are.
Yes, of course.
But that aside, so the thing that's amazing about the venture job, so before I was a VC, I was an attorney. I started out as a litigator, then I became a corporate and licensing attorney. And so being an attorney is actually, in many ways, it's a ton of hours, and it requires intellectual rigor and all these things that I wasn't qualified to do. But it's in some ways a much easier job, because what you do as an attorney is whatever you're told to do. Like, you know, you wake up and you go, huh, what are my instructions today? Write a brief, or, you know, create a contract or whatever. And then when you finish, you hand it off and people go, why, thank you. And then you say, now what shall I do next, right? And in the venture job, there are no requirements. When I wake up in any given morning, it's like, well, what do I do today? Oh, I don't know. Maybe I'll have a breakfast. Maybe I'll meet with an entrepreneur. Maybe I will go to a board meeting. Like, there are a million things that you can do. And actually, I've had this conversation I've been a venture capitalist now for about 17 years. And so for 17 years, I've been having the same conversation with my wife, where I will say, oh, I'm going to be out tonight at this thing, or I've got to fly to so and such and such a place to do this other thing. And she will say, oh, really? Oh, do you have to do that? And I'll say, no. And she'll say, well, why are you doing it? Like, come home. Like, when I started in the venture business, we had four small children. She's like, here's an idea. How about come home to your four small children? I'd say, I don't know what things I need to do as a venture capitalist to be successful. What I do know is that there are a range of things that venture capitalists do, and they all involve trying to be helpful to entrepreneurs, trying to meet amazing entrepreneurs, trying to fund great entrepreneurs, trying to then help them be successful, trying to then help them figure out the path to, you know, building great big businesses that ultimately turn into creating value for my investors. What that looks like in any given day is just different every day.
It's different for every company too, I'd imagine, right?
Absolutely.
Over the 17 years, what's the same, what's different? Because there's been, as we were talking about earlier, venture used to be a little bit more opaque. Having a checkbook, having access to capital made you relevant. The way deal flow came about, the way entrepreneurs would find you or you find them was very different. So I'm only 4 years in. And
baby,
a little baby. In fact, I think David was the first VC I met at the startup I was at after grad school. For a while, I just thought all VCs looked and behaved like David. It was stunning.
Oh, my God. Every VC is 5'4", little Jewish man. It's maddening.
It's so cute. VCs are so cute.
Look at them.
Tiny.
So people will sometimes say now the capital is a commodity. The money is a commodity. There's lots of places to go if you want money. And something that used to be more inbound, you know, build the right relationships with the engineering professors, the CEOs, and they'll send the smart people to you, has become a little bit more outbound. And what that means for different people, different funds, it's, you know, depends upon one's personality, one's strategy. But I do think while the variability and the trying to figure out who you are as an investor is the same, the things you might put on that calendar look very different than maybe in 2000 when David started.
You're listening to venture capitalists David Hornick, Amy Arrett, and Hunter Walk. They're joined in conversation by Sue Kwan on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
It's interesting, too, because part of your bio said you have bottom-up investments. What does that mean, and is that a reflection of what you're interested in, and you can pick and choose what
you
feel?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think so. One of the things that dictates your investment style is your fund strategy and fund size. My partner and I, when we started, wanted to optimize for a few things. Ease of decision-making, so there's just two of us. Being able to make a relatively for early stage, small number of investments a year, so we could concentrate our dollars behind a smaller number of companies, which meant that we could spend time with them, not just write the check, tell them to send us an email every 30 days, and go try to find the next hot investment. And also ultimately be judged by the investments we make, not the investments we don't make. So I can be wrong lots and lots and lots of times, so long as I'm right a handful of times. And the larger the fund, the harder it is to do that, because if you have a $1 billion fund, there's only so many companies that are going to be a meaningful business for you to invest in, and you have to find those companies and invest in them, you know, before the other large funds do. So while I always want founders to tell me about what the future is going to look like, I'm not figuring it out for myself and just looking for people who agree with me. I think my partner and I have certain beliefs about what's happening from a macro economy, and we think we are leaving behind industrial capitalism, and we are early in, you know, a wave of technology-driven capitalism, which fortunately, and we think technology, that's a good thing, means that industries that didn't typically benefit from technology or predated the invention of the computer, construction, automotive, agriculture, are seeing waves of innovation from software and hardware that allow them to be smarter, allow them to use software, allows the farmer who used to have to go, you know, do a hand measurement of soil salinity or something, can actually get that measured, reported back, so on and so forth, and alter, you know, his or her plans accordingly. So we tend to invest in companies that whose benefits reach beyond, let's say, the Fortune 500 and the wealthiest 1% of consumers, but try to improve the lives of smaller businesses, teams, individuals.
There's a really funny scene. I don't know if anyone watches Silicon Valley, the TV series. But
it's too real.
Yes. There's a PR person, so it's very close to my heart, who's like, you have to have something in there that says you're making lives better, or that you're saving, tech, ... is making lives better, or saving lives. But it's true in that technology can now do more.
Yeah, and what
and
I find
it
is,
should have an
it's not my
impact.
Judgment, right? If it doesn't resonate with me, that's not the entrepreneur's problem. That's my problem. They deserve investors who are 100% committed, and so that's why, you know, at Homebrew we try to figure out, hey, does this person's vision of the way the world should work get us excited, and do they have a missionary zeal? So if you think of sort of like a missionary mercenary spectrum, we want missionaries who, you know, are going to be good business operators, as opposed to, you know, mercenaries who necessarily may have a higher probability of making $1, but maybe aren't going to be the people who build the truly transformative companies.
Do we have a better breed of entrepreneur and founder now these days? Do you think the founders are getting better as VCs are getting better?
Well, I mean, in some ways, that's a good question for Amy, because, first of all, she lived through, you were a successful and great entrepreneur to start, and then you got, like happens oftentimes, like, oh, you're really good at that thing, why don't you come be a VC, which is sort of nonsensical. It's like, hey, you're a really great juggler, why don't you come cook me dinner? Like, you know. Yeah. But in the meantime, you've been, you saw a lot of entrepreneurs from the perspective we have, and you returned to being an entrepreneur. And my sense is that people come to you for advice a lot. And so I'm just curious how do you choose who you're mentoring, and do you see them being, you know, sort of more thoughtful and smarter, or is every generation of entrepreneur just as dopey as the last. And I mean that with the greatest of affection. But, you know, like, there's so many things to learn to figure out how to build a company, right?
Where should I start?
I mean, yeah, please. I mean,
I think entrepreneurs are getting better. And the reason for that is that, much like as being an investor, people talk about pattern recognition. Well, it's the same thing in being an entrepreneur, right? Like, the more times you do this, the more pain and suffering you understand is part of the gig. And the shortcuts that you learn about the mistakes that you made once before are things that you can just cut through, right? So I'm a much different CEO than I was probably, you know, it's my fourth company. So my significant other is out in the audience. And when I told her that I was leaving being a VC, she's a very nice person, by the way. And when I told her that I was leaving being a VC, she paused. She rarely says things like this. And she then said, "You're kidding me, right?"
Yeah.
So anybody who is...
Why, though? What is it about your personality? Did she think that...
don't think it was just special for me.
Oh.
I think it's the fact that the kind of commitment, right? The 24/7, the... You know, when people come to me for mentoring and they say, you know, I want to be an entrepreneur, like, what, this thing called work-life balance. And I just usually am drinking water and I spit it out at the moment. And I think, though, that's a great theory. There is no work-life balance. You are doing something that is so hard that, you know, it's almost look, I mean, as an ex-VC, and I had a couple of great outcomes, but a lot of really not good ones. Right? And, you know, folks here who have run stuff and invested in stuff, on one hand, you can name the things that have been extraordinary outcomes. So whenever people talk about, like, well, you know, that's easy, it's incredibly hard. And it's just an honor to even get to a place that you establish there's a minimal viable product, you have a business. And from there, the thought process of scaling it and then having some level of an outcome. These are very, very difficult things, and they're not for people who don't have... I think the number one thing that I learned about being a great entrepreneur and picking great entrepreneurs personally is all about resilience. Hmm. It's all about, no matter what happens, I'm not going to let that beat me. I'm going to figure out how to go over the mountain, through the mountain, around the mountain, and just keep on doing that and create positive energy for the teams that you can put together.
So since you brought it up, how is work-life balance for you? Or should I ask the...
I think she just got up and went.
So, how do you do it differently now as a CEO?
Because somebody said to me, because now you're mature, that means old, thank you.
Yeah. Oh.
I'm not sure that I'm very good at it. I mean, I think I've gotten better, because at least I'm conscious that it's a problem, right? Mm. Right. The first place to start is consciousness, like Pamela saying to David, maybe you want to come home and see your kids, you know? But I prioritize, but I'm not always great at it, because you can't, you know, it's impossible to have one of these things work well, but if you're not in it 24/7, I think it's pretty hard. So I'm pretty good at it, but not terrific.
Most VCs I meet have this quality of having to always, like, FOMO, fear of missing out on anything, whether it's a game or a meal, or is that not true? I mean,
I might be the least FOMO.
Okay.
For me, the greatest difference moving from operating to investing was, although both equally intense, the intensity in operating for me was narrow but deep. Mm. I ran a product team. I had sort of 40 people reporting to me, but I understood my scope, mm-hmm. And it was intense and long days. And, you know, my wife and I sort of, like, didn't see much of each other, but I knew, like, when something felt done, I could stop. The 25th, like, sort of more like the legal, like, oh, the 25th hour is done on this. It's finished. Or this, great, Larry approved that. Okay, done. I find in venture there's always another first hour.
Yeah,
there's always another person to meet, another company to look at, another technology to evaluate. And so you kind of have to decide, given a limited amount, a finite amount of time and energy, which things are you going to do where hopefully the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. So for me, there's a just, and why I think the FOMO doesn't kick in, is just there's a there's a bunch of lanes that I've decided aren't my lanes. And so I don't need the entrepreneurs and the people who play in those lanes aren't likely to be the ones that I work with. It's not part of my focus. I've had to give some things up in order to, you know, my fund and my family sort of started in the same kind of year having a child. And, like, those are the two things. And I don't know if I'd necessarily be like that if I was a more traditionally maybe, you know, had entered an existing fund kind of covering the consumer space for some, you know, successful partnership. It might be harder for me to make some of those decisions, but that was, you know, another reason why sort of, you know, knowing ourselves well enough to design an investing structure and a fund structure around what we thought we could be good at.
So for people who are like my dad, who watch CNBC 24/7, who are really interested in the companies that are creating jobs and in the products and so on, how much should the general public pay attention to who is funding a company in terms of their reputation, whether or not that company will be successful? And I'm kind of asking this under the guise of, you know, of investing and what, you know, we seem to be in a little bit of a lift, and you read all these things about IPO, and then you have a day like today. And then, you know, so I think that's just one more element to consider. And is who is the VC or the backer important to the general public?
So the bigger question is, should the general public be worrying about startups at all, right? There's this big, there's been this move towards, oh, we need to let consumers invest in startups, right? Consumers aren't given the opportunity to make all these amazing gains by not being able to invest early in Facebook, right? And you've heard this earlier, like, oh, yeah, there are amazing companies out there, but actually the real opportunity is to lose money, right? The opportunity that is venture capital is the opportunity to find little companies, invest in them, and more likely than not lose that money, right? And so
how often, what is the stat for losing money versus the big winner? Is there a ratio out there, 1 to 20? I'm just curious.
I don't know that there's a general rule. I'd say that between 2000 and 2010, if you invested a dollar in the venture capital industry as a whole, you returned less than a dollar.
Really?
So betting on venture capital meant you were losing money. Now there were, and it was actually way worse than that sounds.
Right. The average startup fails and the average venture fund loses money.
Yeah.
That's not what you see in the media.
But a small set of funds and a small set of companies do disproportionately well. And so there's inevitably that desire to be, oh, I could be the next Facebook, right? Mm-hmm. We could create the next Airbnb. I could fund the next, amazing company, whatever that is. So in the startup world, there is some indication that a set of very good venture funds have disproportionately funded amazing companies. And therefore, they tend to then get an opportunity to see the next set of excellent companies, and they tend to be able to do a couple of other things pretty well. They can convince people to join those companies, even though joining a little company is insane. And they can then convince the next set of investors to put money into those companies, even though that company is likely to lose their money. And so those things alone, right, the capacity to raise additional capital and the capacity to find amazing entrepreneurs give the companies funded by these select set of investors a wild advantage over others. So does it matter? It absolutely matters. But will it matter ultimately to an individual who's investing in the public markets? It probably doesn't, because you shouldn't be investing as an individual
Even pick the best venture fund at any given time, they will have multiple companies within a fund that go to zero. So it's a power, you know, even when you're good, it's a power law business, and there's going to be a few. So if August Capital has a fund, several hundred million dollars, they use that to invest in, let's say, 20 companies, you know, two of those companies are going to be what make them most of their money. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you could say, wow, you know, I want to, August has invested in that one company, and that might be a good sign. It's a better sign than, you know, somebody we haven't heard of investing in that company, but it doesn't mean you necessarily want to, you know, buy that one company. That's why, you know, sort of the universities, endowments, the people who give David money, like, they're buying all of his partner's judgment and all of those companies over some period of time with the notion that in aggregate it's going to outperform the
plus
other options.
Plus 19 other venture funds, yeah. Right? I mean, that's the reality is that the venture business is a portfolio, and investors in venture capital have a portfolio of venture capital funds. And as a whole, if you bet on great venture capitalists who are betting on great entrepreneurs, you will do disproportionately well. But that's a whole lot of ifs, right?
Yeah, and you hear so much about the venture capital industry also condensing and merging and some going away and so on in the last recession. And then you also have globalization, right? There seem to be more funds coming in to fund as well as entrepreneurs who are going out. I mean, what's your experience been with Madison Reed? Are you international or did you – because I know you did some R&D outside – of the U.S.
Yeah, our hair color is made actually in the EU, in Italy. All of our customers are North America at this time. We sell one product through Sephora that happens to be some Sephora's in Canada, but that's not direct from Madison Reed. But one thing I wanted to just touch on, which I would suspect if there's more than the one entrepreneur in the room, that I think is interesting is the other side of the equation, right? The equation of how does an entrepreneur think about taking venture capital money? Because I think this is a issue that I mentor a lot of people about who come to me that have gotten multiple term sheets or are struggling because there's, on one hand, people will say, well, you just have to get the money, right? It doesn't matter. Whoa, yes, it does. It matters a lot. And, you know, my investors are, terrific. Series A, Series B investors with great track records. It was important for me to pick partners, not just the firm, that I knew and trusted and understood what they were looking for. And I think Hunter said a really super interesting thing, which is, you know, it's like a team member going to a company. It isn't all about whether the company wants them. It's about whether the partnership works between you. Well, it's the same thing around, you know, really good venture people actually know what right looks like for them. And what I mean by that is they have enough pattern recognition to know that kind of entrepreneur in that kind of space, and my network can help move the dial. And I think that there are a couple of things that I just want to mention for people that are out there that they don't think about. So one is, who's the partner and why does that matter? Well, partnerships, in Hunter's case, and there's two, so that makes it a little bit easier to understand. In some partnerships where there's 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 partnerships have complexity to them. And that often has a complexity where somebody can get deals done and somebody can't. And if you're doing a deal with a partner that doesn't have a lot of clout or is not in great standing in their own partnership when it comes to follow-on investments, or your company isn't doing that well but needs the partner to convince their partners to kind of let it ride, these are things dynamically that you don't know when you're the entrepreneur. Second thing is, you should always find out where the fund is in its fund. Mm-hmm. Meaning, funds are typically 10-year legal entities, 5 years to invest the capital, 5 years to harvest the capital. And so let's assume that a fund is year 4, and you're the last, you know, one of two investments that a fund's going to make. And now you have shortened the time period for you to have some sort of outcome, mm-hmm. right? Because now instead of having 10 years, being in the beginning of the fund, now you have 6. And in addition, what happens if there's not a lot of reserves? Meaning you get to a place where the fund hasn't either planned accordingly or when they need follow-on money, it may not be readily available. I mean, these are things that are really critical to dig into because the capital is one thing, but I am convinced that it's really about the dynamics, the board dynamics. Really critical. You should pick partners and your board members that are actually accretive to your business, that you don't walk into the board meeting dreading going to the board meeting, but rather are felt lifted up and supported by your board members. And this is all stuff that often entrepreneurs, it's hard to know that until you've been through it.
How much of it is a mutual decision and how much of it is the VC saying, I'm doing this or I'm...
I wish I was the entrepreneur that could make every VC in the world give me money. I tried. I've tried. You know, I put David in a headlock once. he was 6'4" when I started talking to him, and look what happened. Yeah, exactly. And it still didn't work. But my point is that for the most part, the venture firm and the partner is making the decision. There are certain situations where, you know, and I'm not trying to, you know, if Hunter decided to start a company and not being a VC anymore, there'd be tons of people standing in line trying to convince him that they should be the ones so lucky to have someone like him to fund. So most of the time it's the VC making the decision. I think there are situations where certain entrepreneurs who have great track records where it's a competitive situation.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features venture capitalists David Hornick, Amy Arrett, and Hunter Walk. They're joined in conversation by Sue Kwan. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
And I found that the best opportunities are not auctions, in the sense that it's not, you know, 10 VCs all want to do the deal and the best terms are the ones that win it. Just like the best VCs are thinking, as I think Amy said earlier, what can I do to help? You don't want to, it's this weird sort of intersection of wanting to invest in situations where you might be able to provide assistance, but not wanting to invest in people who need your help to succeed. Because you want something that is, you know, underway, growing, so on and so forth, but where you can, you know, you can accelerate it. At key moments, you might be able to provide guidance, might be able to provide an introduction, but it's not Moneyball. You're not looking for, you know, sort of below average things that if you put together, you can kind of like get it to good. I know that's not the true definition of Moneyball. It's characteristics that are undervalued by the market, but you get it. You don't get rewarded as a VC for investing in average companies and making them slightly above average. You get rewarded for investing in companies that probably would have been awesome even without your help, trying to help, and then silently taking a little bit of satisfaction that maybe you did help.
You know, I funded this company. These two professors out of USC that were brilliant, brilliant statisticians and mathematicians, and they created a platform that took the video feeds from every professional basketball game, sucked in the video feeds, converted it into data, and then coaches could use that platform to figure out, oh, when I have this player against this player, what's the right thing to do? Who should I put? You know, make a bunch of very interesting decisions based on data. And I ultimately gave these entrepreneurs a term sheet, and I convinced they had a bunch of term sheets. I convinced them they should take my money, and I invested in the company. I went on the board, and I was meeting the CEO's wife, and she said something, and I was talking about these board meetings, because you would not be surprised that I go to these board meetings for this company. It's called Second Spectrum. It's an amazing, truly amazing technology. And the beginning of the board meeting was all about, did you see that game? And did you, I mean, like, oh, remember, did you see what happened? Blah, blah, blah. And I just sort of wait, because I don't know anything about basketball. Like, you know. And so I was telling Rajiv's wife this story, like, oh, my God, by the time they finish, then we can get on with the meeting. And she said, so why'd you invest in the company? If you're not excited about basketball, why did you invest in the company? And and I said, because I'm excited about your husband. I'm excited about what he can do to transform basketball, not about basketball, you know? And so my role in that company isn't about how can I help you understand the game of basketball, although on that board with me is the former CEO of ESPN. Guess what? He can do that. He's really good. It's one of the owners of the Warriors is on that board. He can do that. I'm not. That's not my job. My job, as I see it, is, hey, let's think about hiring. Let's understand how you're building the technology. Let's negotiate this interesting license with, you know, X, Y, and Z. And as long as the people around the table understand that everybody has a role to play and that we can all, you know, push this incredible boulder up the hill, then great. You know, you don't have to be everything. You just have to be someone who's helpful and supportive and valuable.
So to broaden it out a little bit, what about the people who support you? So VC, you run like a business. So how does one work for you? Like if someone says, I would love to do marketing for them, or I would love to do research for that company, or I want to learn how to become a VC and see if I have what it takes. You don't post on Indeed. So how does that work? And how do people get in? I mean, you started, your first job was with Conan, right? Over, I have no idea how that led to this.
That's not a typical VC path. Late night television.
Good training. You all came from different paths. So what would your advice be?
I mean, by the way, Amy was on one of the greatest basketball teams.
Was this UConn? She wouldn't tell me. Was that the?
Yes. Okay, no. I mean,
so
you don't want to.
Competitive.
you want to understand perseverance and grit and whatever. Be like an extraordinarily small person on one of the best basketball teams in the country. That's just madness. Like being a short VC. Like who cares? Give that dude something to sit on.
Okay.
You know, but
we want to work for either of you. How would a person go about getting into your industry?
No, the venture business is a crazy business. Like, there is no, what I say to folks who are interested in the venture business is that there is not really a clear path to the venture business. And therefore, doing something to become a venture capitalist is a bad idea because in all likelihood, you won't become a venture capitalist. And therefore, you've done a set of things that you may not have liked in order to be a VC. And so what I say is like, do things that you like doing, and if those things coincide with the startup ecosystem and venture capital, et cetera, that's great, right? I had been a startup attorney. The reason I ended up in venture capital is that I was this startup lawyer, and I would go to board meetings, and instead of being quiet and taking notes and, like, you know, alerting the management when they were going to do something illegal, I'd say, oh, my God, you know what you should do? You should totally, like, do this thing and that thing or whatever. Now, mind you, one of my clients fired me for doing exactly this. They're like, who are you? Like, you're not on the board. You're the lawyer. Shut up, you know? But I was representing Evite, and two of the four partners at August at that time were on the Evite board, and they were like, yeah, what he said, you know? And eventually they're like, have you ever thought about the venture business? To which I said, yes. Please, I'm so excited about the venture business. You know,
cool.
It wasn't a path. It was just that I couldn't shut up, you know? And then I described that, hey, Mom, I'm a venture capitalist. She's like, what's a venture capitalist? And I said, oh, it's this thing, and here's what we do. And her response was, oh, my God, you talked your way into a job that only involves talking. And I was like, I said, yeah, totally. And she was like, nice, good job. That's the perfect job for you, you know.
Awesome.
I don't know. Maybe you have a better answer than that, Hunter, although
Amy, you didn't do all the talking to get into your role. You were in finance, right? Were you in the banking area in industry before? Or?
No, I was an entrepreneur. So I got into venture from being an entrepreneur and I went sort of kicking and screaming. So I was what's called an EIR, which is an entrepreneur in residence, and thinking I was just going to start something again, and then got put on a couple of boards and then got a return of capital. And then the firm that I was an EIR at never had a Bay Area office. And so maybe you'd like to help us sort of think through that. And before I knew it, I, you know, was on a board, like three boards with Hornick.
Yeah.
stayed. So for me, I think the interesting part for me, just honestly, was I got to start a new venture firm in a region which was more entrepreneurial. Mm. But the real truth is that my DNA is to sort of, you know, build teams, kind of come up with crazy ideas that no one seems to think are that good. And then
they give you millions of dollars.
Then
it's
they
so
give me
curious.
Millions of dollars, and hopefully they'll be good ideas. So
I had a challenging path as a tall, white, straight male who went to Stanford and worked at Google.
That is hard.
I don't really pattern match
you had
against
to, you had
venture.
To, I mean, you had to literally claw your way into the venture business, didn't you?
The world's just stacked up against you, Hunter, isn't it?
Hunter, you know, if you had gotten a computer music degree like me, you'd have nailed it.
Born on third base, David Hornick.
Yeah.
I decided, the way I did it was I decided I actually didn't like venture capital. I mean, I didn't, the interest from some of the larger funds that I'd known over time, and especially as sort of I started to, you know, check off some of those boxes and be seen as somebody who might be an interesting new addition to the partnership, I realized, like, wow, that tickles my ego that they'd be interested in me, but it doesn't tickle my passion. That, like, I don't want to go be part of a 7-person firm, a 12-person mm-hmm. firm, you know, sort of have a box that I'm supposed to be in and be the junior, you know, deal with the partnership dynamics, not be an equal partner, all these things that are difficult as a junior person. I also felt like I didn't need to do the type of investing that I wanted to do. I didn't need that structure. So my partner who I had worked with at Google and who also had done venture before in his career, so I figured I'd get some of the mentorship from Satya, he said, like, this is, you know, we sort of designed the fund that we would have wanted to take money from. And so that's sort of like, I guess, the entrepreneur's approach to venture, which is you go and you raise a venture fund, you know, and then some period of time later, there's no vanity metrics. Like, it comes down to, did you give, you know, exactly. enough money back to your investors that they want to continue to give you money? It doesn't matter, you know, they can like you, that's fine. But if you underperform, like, you know, those endowments, those foundations, the people that we work on behalf of, you know, rather give it to somebody else. So it was just sort of a, like, you know, we built our own, I guess, and it remains, you know, we're happy with our progress 4 years in, but every company we've invested in is still either undervalued or overvalued, and we'll honor definitely undervalued, and we'll definitely find, you know, continue to find that out, you know, in the years to come.
It's exciting.
Okay. We're going to bring the lights up a little bit and just put up your hand, and either Becky or I will get to you, and I see two eager people over there, so coming to you.
So to what degree it exists, I think it does, but the idea of a venture capitalist company that does for social good and social impact, where the earnings may not be as great as what you guys would be hoping, but someone especially who's a second generation, who's already made a lot of money as a venture capitalist, taking it to that level, again, for social good, for social impact specifically, does it exist? Does the model work for that, and why don't we see more of it?
Sure. I think there's actually a spectrum, right? There's on the far end is nonprofits that have an operating budget that's entirely donated, and so every year you start the year saying, okay, I gotta find the capital to run this year, and you spend it, build a business, build your nonprofit. On the other end of the spectrum is a strictly for-profit business. It's a business that is engaged in creating, an enterprise that makes money, ultimately, ideally makes more money than it costs and goes public, et cetera. And then there are these businesses increasingly that fall somewhere in between on the spectrum, right? And there are certainly investors who are interested in those businesses where you could say, like, okay, somewhere closer to the nonprofit world, it's a self-sustaining business, right? Ideally, you put money into some enterprise that's doing great good in the world, but it makes enough money to support itself. So in the beginning of the year, you don't have to, I'm going to now need to raise another $5 or $10 million to make it through the year. And the return on that investment isn't about dollars, it's about public good. Right, and I talk with lots and lots of entrepreneurs who are built social entrepreneurs who are building, devices, etc., services that serve the public, where the real value, the real return is in lives saved or healthier children or cleaner water, all those things. And there are for sure a ton of people who are interested in saying, "Hey, I have money that I'd like to put to work to create that value." Right. And the biggest challenge is that oftentimes there's sort of this confusion between the two, and people say, like, oh, I'm coming to venture capitalists because you should care about the planet, etc. And the reality is my job as a venture capitalist is to take money from amazing organizations, universities, foundations, etc., who are doing great things with that money, and try to turn it into as much money as I possibly can so they can do more great things. It is not my job in the purely commercial venture business to try and do great things and return some money to them. And so I think that we have to be clear which of those things we are doing and which of those things you are seeking. But to the more specific question, there are for sure individuals who are creating funds. The Steyers have created a fund that is very much focused on this. There are others who have created those funds.
So I'll go at it a slightly different way, which is the company that I've founded called Madison Reed is a hair color company, and we have the lowest chemical profile of any hair color that exists. Now, one would ask, why would we go through that time, that energy, added cost? And I'll make it really super clear, because we care. We actually have a product that we feel is the best out there in the market in efficacy, but actually we feel as if the benefits of that product aren't harsh chemicals. So I believe deeply in that purpose. That's the reason that I had a mission to start the company, which was to dispel to consumer packaged good companies that bad stuff has to be in personal care. And if you are coloring your hair, and I'm sure none of the women here are, repetitively, I would offer to you that putting ammonia and PPD and resorcinol and parabens on your hair every 4 weeks is probably on your scalp, not maybe the best thing, which is why they tell you when you're pregnant, don't color your hair. And so that's an example of a company that's got a mission. We're not going to put bad things in our product because it's cheaper or better. We believe in the product. Having said that, I believe that that mission will deliver a huge return on the value of the company, because I believe that consumers see right through things and believe in companies that have a mission and are willing to stand with what's honest about that mission and won't waver on that. So I come at it a slightly different way.
So I want to thank you all for coming tonight. Most of all, I want to thank our panel. Thank you so very much. Have a wonderful evening. Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guests were venture capitalists David Hornick, Amy Arrett, and Hunter Walk. They were joined in conversation by Sue Kwan. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalet, Maya Finley, and Jake Gukowski. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rasha Neem Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.